I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Q. I want to tell you about this new book called Never Been Better. It's a romantic comedy, but it's not your typical romantic comedy. I mean, it does a lot of stuff that romantic comedies do. Unrequited love and missed opportunities and playful humor and embarrassing mishaps. But instead of the characters meeting at a Christmas fair or at a big corporate conference, the main characters in this book met in a psychiatric ward. So as well as tackling love, they're also dealing with the actualities of mental health issues and recovery. Never Been Better is the debut book by the Canadian writer Leanne Toshko Simpson. Here's the thing. Leanne herself suffers from bipolar disorder. She too has spent some time as a patient on a psychiatric ward. And Leanne dropped by our studio to talk about this new book, Never Been Better, and a little bit about why she wrote it. And it was a really interesting conversation. I mentioned that word actualities a little while ago. I don't even know if I'm using that correctly. But what I mean by that is, like, there's sort of a new romantic version of being mentally unwell. And Leanne wants to talk a little bit about what it's actually like. Here's our conversation. How are you?
Oh, thanks so much for having me. This is really cool.
It's really cool to have you. Congratulations on it.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been kind of funny. People are like, so how do you feel about everyone knowing that you were in a psych ward? And I'm just like, well, I feel like you could Google me and find that out in 5 seconds beforehand. So now it's just like, I was in a psych ward and there is a very happy ending.
Yeah. Can I ask when?
Yeah, it was about 11 years ago. Me and my friend just celebrated our 11-year anniversary. The book came out, I think it was like a day off the day that I went in.
Oh, wow.
In March, yeah.
How old were you?
I was 20.
So the plan was, from what I understand, originally you were thinking, I'm going to write a memoir.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who have certain lived experiences or marginalizations are often expected to write memoir in a way that, you know, you're putting the truth down on the page.
Here's
what
happened.
Yeah, and you're educating people, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I did want to educate people. I mean, I'm a teacher. I love to teach people about mental health. But a lot of the time, you got to trick people to really get them to learn. And so I love the idea of a rom-com because, you know, it offered the promise of a happy ending that people with mental illness don't always have. And at the same time, it was like a structure that you could play with the rules for in terms of mental illness. Who deserves love? Who deserves recovery? How do we work towards these things that we want so deeply? And a rom-com offered a really nice way to get people to learn about mental health, but not necessarily have that be the thing that attracts them to it in the first place.
You felt like if it was just a story, but just about mental health, people might not be as inclined to...
Yeah, people don't want to be sad.
I often say that, I have this conversation with a couple of people, people don't want to have porridge. They don't want to have, you know, this is good for you. They want to be entertained.
They want to enjoy it. And I often argue that people with mental illness have some of the best senses of humor that I've ever seen because you have to survive.
Yeah.
And so I really tried to channel that part of my experience into the book and offer a story that was full of hope. Like, yes, there's hard parts to living with mental illness. Yes, there were days where I didn't know if I'd get to tomorrow. But when you have people around you who believe in you, you eventually, I think, start believing in yourself. And I think this book is really a testament to that. I mean, it took over 10 years to come together, but I'm so glad that I'm here and it's here.
How many rom-coms did you watch while you were writing this book?
Oh, you know what's funny? So I watch a lot of rom-coms as comfort watches. I
think like McConaughey's, Barrymore's?
The Wedding Planner is one of my favorites.
Yeah, is that Jennifer Lopez?
Jennifer Lopez.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good one.
Because also, like, you know, I was a person of color watching rom-coms where there weren't a lot of people of color. So Jennifer Lopez was one of my favorites forever.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you were watching, you love rom-coms. So you sort of knew the world of rom-coms that you wanted to write about in this book.
I think I knew a very specific time of rom-coms, though. Like, I feel like late 90s, early 2000s. I don't think I watched that many of them. And maybe it wasn't just me. I think there was actually a gap in rom-coms being produced maybe in like the 2010s. Like I can remember No Strings Attached. Yeah. I can remember Friends with Benefits.
Yeah.
But I think there was a bit of a gap in that. And the next one that I really latched onto was Silver Linings Playbook.
What meds are you on?
Me? None. I used to be on lithium and Seroquel and Abilify, but I don't take them anymore. No. They make me foggy and they also make me bloated.
Yeah. I was on Xanax and Effexor, but I agree it wasn't as sharp, so I stopped.
How about Trazodone?
Trazodone?
Oh, it flattens you out. I mean, you are done. It takes the light right out of your eyes.
God, I bet it does.
Is that a rom-com?
Well, see, I think that's why I'm weird. I believe that it's a rom-com.
How to show your work.
Okay, so it is two people. Rom-coms, actually, if you look at the scholarly literature, and I do because I have to teach in universities.
Yeah.
But rom-coms are actually long been positioned as a conservative genre where people have to kind of find belonging in society and through partnership in order to be accepted.
Yeah.
And so Silver Linings Playbook is really interesting because it's someone going through recovery in order to be accepted by his ex-wife. But the plot twist, I mean, I can't ruin a movie that has been out for a decade, is that the ex-wife doesn't actually want to be with him. And he is repressing an episode that he had that tore apart their marriage. And so it's not really about him chasing this love of his ex-wife after all. It's about him recovering. And through his recovery, he meets someone who might be a better match for him. And that is Jennifer Lawrence, if you watch the movie.
I am understanding why you wrote this book now.
Yeah. I also feel like sometimes people get weird when I say it's a rom-com, but in my heart, I believe it is the kind of romance that people with mental illness often need to find, where sometimes we're chasing something that we think will fix us. And the reality is we have to kind of look at ourselves and learn to be okay with who we are and what we've done and find that forgiveness. And while we're doing that, good things happen along the way. So that's kind of the setup.
When you say you wanted to teach people about mental illness, What do you mean by that? What do you think people need to learn that you wanted to get across in this book?
Well, I think that people are starting to get a pretty good handle on depression and anxiety.
Yeah.
I think that...
Yeah, they're big. They're big ones right now.
They're big ones. I think that there's a lot of TikToks about them, and I love that.
Yeah.
But I think that some of the other illnesses like borderline personality disorder, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder...
People are not as comfortable talking about that.
Yeah, I don't know if they have too many letters or people just like check out halfway through. And
I find that when you bring up mental health is, if as long as you're talking about anxiety or depression or ADHD or something like that, people are like, well, it's great, we're being brave, we're going to do it. And then as soon as you bring up any of the what you mentioned, people get kind of quiet.
I think it's hard because a lot of mental health strategies are often positioned around productivity in a way. And I there are lots of strategies that you can build into your everyday life to kind of ease an illness that you're living with and learn to deal with it better. But sometimes when I'm manic, I am just manic. I cannot go to work that day. I will try to throw a carnival. It is my go-to thing when I'm manic. I'm like, let's throw the biggest party ever. And they're like, Leanne, you have not been out of bed in 2 weeks.
Yeah, right.
And I just can't remember that. And so I think that when you're trying to incorporate an individual into society, it's harder when some of your symptoms aren't as easy to manage. And often people take those symptoms, like mania in particular, people take it as kind of like a personal affront at times. Like how could you act like this? How could you forget about this day that we had planned? How could you cancel these plans?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the time we're in survival mode in those moments, and we have to take burdens off of ourselves so that we can recuperate and show up the next day. Sometimes we just have to say, this day is a write-off. I would like to be better in the next day or maybe a couple days from now. And I think it takes a lot of bravery to articulate that to people who you are going to disappoint. And what I hope is that people become less disappointed and more understanding that we're doing this to preserve the longevity of our relationships and the structures that help us live.
I understand now that how I came across that in the book, but in the most subtle way in this beautiful love story. Speaking of, do you want to feel like reading a little bit for us?
Yeah, I can take a read.
So I was hoping you might read from the very first page. And while you get the page together, I'll set it up. So Dee, Misa, and Matt all live with bipolar disorder. The story takes place a year after they have left the psychiatric ward. Misa and Matt are getting married in Turks and Caicos. They invite Dee, the narrator of the book, we'll talk about that in a second, to their wedding. So yeah, go ahead.
When my invitation for Matt and Misa's destination wedding arrived in the mail, Tilly pinned it to the dartboard in our kitchen. Accept with pleasure or decline with regret, she snorted as she read. Why is there never a checkbox for drain the open bar with relative apathy, especially if they're not even giving you a plus one? She yanked a couple of darts from the board and took 5 steps backward, bumping into the kitchen table. Narrowing her eyes, she whipped a single dart at the wall, then turned to me, noticing my pursed lips. Are you okay? I surveyed the damage. My sister had punctured the palm tree crest, but the perfectly staged photo of Matt and Misa on the invitation remained intact. Burly in an ink blue suit, Matt had his arms wrapped around Misa, who was beaming in a blush satin dress. She glanced over her shoulder at him with a warmth that made me think of breakfast in bed, shared bottles of dinner wine, joint bank accounts. All the things I could barely imagine for myself. He looks like he's gonna absorb her, murmured Tilly, suddenly beside me. Like a matrimonial sponge. It's fine, I said, a little too loudly. I'm fine. I knew this was coming. I've prepared myself for this moment for months. Actually, excuse me, because I have to go do this thing in the bathroom.
There's, we won't continue on to what exactly happens in the bathroom there, but pretty clear that the protagonist here, Dee, is hung up on Matt, right?
She's hung up on Matt, and she doesn't have the best coping strategies in the world. I will tell you that right now.
Right. She doesn't really know what to do with that.
And I think it's also that she is very tangled up in the idea of love in recovery, because in a lot of rom-coms, when you work on yourself, you get to be with someone else. And she feels like she's been working on herself for the past year, and yet it's him and Misa who are getting married and not her. And she feels a little betrayed.
When I was reading the book, I was sort of, this is going to sound silly, but I was like reading it, and I think just as I do any book, I trust the lead character. Like, I'm reading it through their eyes, and I'm like, oh yeah, they're going to tell me what's going on. And then it doesn't take, I can see you smiling right now and laughing. It didn't take me long. Well, it actually did take me a long time to realize, like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be trusting everything that's going on through Dee's eyes in this book. So can you talk to me a little bit about that? Maybe what I experienced there, maybe, you know, whether or not you wanted to make her an unreliable narrator?
Yeah, I think the idea of unreliable narrators and mental illness is very interesting, because often madness is positioned as like they're telling the story and you can't believe them, and there's this twist and they've been hiding everything from you, the reader, all along. But in this case, I think Dee is an unreliable narrator in the sense that she's hiding a lot of stuff from herself. And as the book goes on, you can kind of see that some of the pieces aren't fitting together the way that she thinks that they are. And so it's more of a trick on you, and more of a way for her to come to terms with some of the things that she's been avoiding when thinking about her relationship with Matt and Misa.
That's such a great point. You're right, because there was no part of me that thought like, oh, she got me, or like, oh, they got me. You know, the feeling I got was almost like a compassion or a love, you know, for the ways that I didn't really understand the story as it was going on.
Yeah. And I think one of the hallmarks of mental illness is that, especially bipolar disorder, you lose your insight first. So you are narrating to the best of your ability.
Yeah.
You really do see the world that way a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And the people around you are often gently trying to nudge you, or less gently if you're in a psychiatric ward sometimes,
yeah.
to say, hey, this isn't really what's happening.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. Coming up, more of my conversation with Leanne Toshko Simpson.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
I
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. You're in the middle of my conversation with Leanne Toshiko Simpson. The Canadian author has just released her debut novel, Never Been Better. And as you're hearing, it's a rom-com with a lot of mental health issues at its heart. Leanne is Japanese-Canadian, and one of the things the book brings up is the intergenerational trauma created by Japanese internment during World War II. It's something that Leanne's grandmother lived through, and Leanne's grandmother actually kind of appears as a character in Leanne's book. I say kind of on purpose. So I wanted to ask Leanne about that. And by the way, she uses the term Nisei. It means a second-generation Japanese immigrant, in this case, Japanese-Canadian. Your grandmother shows up in this book, right?
Yeah.
So Misa's grandmother is based on your grandmother.
Yes. I, as a rule, don't take people from real life and put them into books because that's how you lose a lot of friends.
Yeah.
But my grandmother was pretty ill when I was going through the last couple, like when I was writing the book and going through the last couple rounds, I knew that there was a chance that she wouldn't be around to see this book come out. And she did actually pass a couple of days after the final manuscript
went in. Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I miss her a lot.
Yeah.
But by putting her in her very specific mannerisms into this book.
Like what?
Oh, well, I was actually at a Japanese art gallery talking to some Japanese friends about how my grandma refused to go to the Japanese Cultural Center, even though like that was where everyone met everyone's partners when they were dating back in the old days. And she was always like, I don't want people to know what I'm doing or talk about me because the Japanese Canadian community is so small. Uh-huh. And which is so funny because myself as a fourth generation Japanese Canadian, I am constantly looking for other JC people to connect with because I feel like we have such a unique cultural experience.
Yeah.
But every character, like every generation of Misa's family has a bit of a different take on what it means to be Japanese Canadian, what it means to preserve the legacy in the same way that I see that diversity in our community now.
You also talk about internment in the book. Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I'm actually a doctoral scholar studying the intergenerational impact of Japanese-Canadian internment. And sometimes people are a little shook that they learned about World War II history in a rom-com. But to me, I don't think you can talk about mental health and the way it impacts an individual without kind of zooming out a little bit and talking about some of the historical stories that we carry and yeah. the cultural influences that Misa in particular has in this book, because she's trying to deal with her illness, but she's also very much trying to articulate a difficulty that she's facing that is so drastically different than the difficulty that her grandmother faced as an internee.
Your grandmother did come visit you in the hospital, right?
She did, which was very unusual, I think, for a Nisei to be so comfortable. I mean, she was scared for me, of course. Like, I wasn't very well, and yeah. she could tell. But she brought me snacks. She hung out with me. She talked to some of my ward mates, and even though she did not grow up talking about mental health at all, and my mom did not grow up talking about mental health at all, when I had a diagnosis, she immediately started reading everything she could about bipolar disorder.
God love her.
It's amazing. And also, this is a woman who didn't get to finish her education because of incarceration. So it meant so much to me to have her do something that was very much out of her comfort zone, from being from a generation where everything was about safety because they had lost everything in the war.
I mean, that shows up in the book as well, the hospital visits. That must have been really meaningful for you to put in.
Yeah.
You've said that writing this book, even if it had never been published, would have been meaningful to you.
100%. I mean, I've spent years teaching creative writing workshops to people in psychiatric wards and people in mental health centers. And I always tell them it doesn't matter if your work is recognized by anyone else other than you. There's something really powerful about people living with mental illness narrating their own stories, because so often we're narrated by doctors, we're narrated by loved ones who are worried about us. We're narrated maybe through your pharmacist. My pharmacist thinks I'm a wild person, but other people are always telling the story of your life. And so being able to regain that authorship, I think, is something really, really special. And I know that even when I was scared to tell people about my story, whenever I would read at events or I would talk to someone, a bunch of people would come up to me and be like, I'm so glad you said that because I think about this too, and I never know how to say it. And so as I built a bit more confidence as a writer, I realized that, yeah, like I'm writing this book and it is very cathartic for me, but also I hope that this book shows people that there is a market for stories like this, because yeah. mental illness and serious mental illness is more common than people really think.
Why did you name the chapters after songs?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I love that era of 90s, 2000s music. I am a 90s baby. This is all the songs I grew up in Scarborough. Some of these
we got Till It's Gone by Janet Jackson.
Yeah, some of these are in my Scarborough Parks and Rec hip-hop class. Some of them are from Ocean Avenue. My band used to perform in high school, and we had this horribly timed like group jump. You know, there's that kind of break in the song. And we'd always try and do this coordinated jump that we would mess up every single time. But the one night we got it down, we won a battle of the bands.
Come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
And then they asked us to play an encore because we won. And we were like, we only know five songs.
We're out. We did it.
Yeah. And like three of them were metal. So we were like, maybe we can play the singing one.
And you were a screamy metal-y person, right?
I was. I screamed in a metal band for a pretty long time. I am not, like, I know there's a way you can do it without hurting your vocal cords. I never quite figured that out.
Yeah.
But honestly, it was so, such a release for me. Even when I was on disability leave, which is right around the time I wrote the short story that inspired this book, I couldn't go to work. I couldn't get out of bed. I cleaned my apartment obsessively for like 6 hours a day. It was really unhealthy. And to get me out of the house, I decided to join this like internet punk band lottery. It's called Punk Rock Lottery.
Like internet, like you play with people on the
internet? It was a Facebook group and they grouped you with strangers and you went to the rehearsal factory and you had to make an original set and you had a month to do it. And so I started screaming again and performing again because I just needed an outlet for all of the frustration I felt at like having finally gotten well enough to land a 9-to-5 job and then realize that I still couldn't keep up in the way that other people always seem to keep up.
So how did you feel when you were screaming?
Amazing.
Yeah.
I felt amazing. We also did this thing where we live painted during our show and then punched through the canvas at the end.
Come on.
It was amazing. And our show was like maybe a week before I went back to work. And I really felt like performing at this dry vegan bar. It closed down. And I don't think anyone was surprised, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I performed and I went back to work. And I was like, you know, I may burn out of this job again. But I think I know that it's okay to be different. If I need to work differently, I need to articulate that to my boss. Because I burnt out because I was trying to do keep the schedule of someone who doesn't have a disability.
Yeah.
And I definitely am affected by the day-to-day movement of my illness. And so I went back, I asked for accommodations, I advocated for myself, and luckily I had a team that listened at the time. And I was at that job in varying capacities for almost 8 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, the whole time I wrote this book, that's why they get a shout out at the end.
Can you pick a song for us to go out on? From the book?
Of course.
We always play a song after the interview.
I love that.
I mean, I kind of want to. I mean, no, you do it. You do it.
No, what song are you thinking?
You know, we just talked to her. We just talked to Shakira.
Shakira, I know. I saw that. My husband loves Shakira, and that's why Shakira is in this book. But I also think that song, Whenever, Wherever, is really beautiful because it's kind of like it doesn't matter where you are. And I include that in What State of Mind. And that scene, Dee and Tilly are really, their sisterhood bond is so strong. And Tilly is doing everything in her power to protect Dee from herself. And I love that Shakira song because my sister also had that album. And it makes me think of my sister, too. And obviously, my husband really loves Shakira.
Okay, let's play it. Want to do that?
Yeah, I would.
Okay. Hey, lovely to meet you.
You too. I really enjoyed this.
That is Shakira with Whenever, Wherever. That song is the title for Chapter 10 of Leanne Toshiko Simpson's debut novel, Never Been Better, which is a romantic comedy with bipolar disorder at its core. Every chapter of the romantic comedy is a song title, including
that one. And before that, you heard my conversation with Scarborough, Ontario's own Leanne Tushko Simpson. Shout out, Scarborough. Never Been Better is out now. Leanne will be reading from the book at the Fold Festival, the Festival of Literary Diversity in Brampton, Ontario, on May 3rd. The other conversation we have up today, if you haven't got a chance to listen to it yet, is with Derek Whibley, the frontman of the group Sum 41, who are calling it quits. And I was happy that Derek came on to tell us a little bit why. I was sort of surprised that he ended up talking about what it was like to tell his bandmates about it. So you're going to hear that conversation wherever you get your podcast, wherever you got this podcast, next to this one, I'd say. We'll see you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.